discussion continues. I'm Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
September day, were you in the yard with your wife and children, or working on some stage in L.A.? Did you stand there in shock at the sight of that black smoke rising against that blue sky? Did you shout out in anger and fear for your neighbor, or did you just sit down and cry? Did you weep for the children who lost their dear loved ones, pray for the ones who don't know? Did you rejoice for the people who walked from the rubble and sob for the ones left below? Did you burst out with pride for the red, white, and blue, and the heroes who died just doing what they do? Did you look up to heaven for some kind of answer, and look at yourself and what really matters? I'm just a singer of simple songs. I'm not a real political man. I watch CNN, but I'm not sure I can tell you the difference in Iraq and Iran. But I know Jesus, and I talk to God, and I remember this from when I was young. Faith, hope, and love are some good things He gave us, and the greatest is love. Where were you when the world...
Well, of course, that's Alan Jackson with the song that kind of epitomized what a lot of people were feeling and thinking on 9/11. Of course, the world was changed forever on that day, on September 11th, 2001. I don't know exactly where you were at, of course. Many people are giving a number of stories. There's a lot of blogs and a lot of radio programs like this one and television programs that are asking people to recount. Where were you on that day? I remember where I was. I was working in a company, and working in the information technology department of that company. I was pastoring at the time, but I was also working full-time as well, so I was bivocational. And I was actually working with Stephen Lee, was working there with us. Stephen is the person behind the creator of SermonAudio.com. Stephen was working in the graphics department and the website of things, and creating websites for the company, and I was working in the information technology part of the company as well, but more on the operations side of the house. But I remember going by his cubicle, which was close by mine, and he said, hey, look at this, and he had on his screen that a plane had just flown into one of the towers in New York City, of course, one of the World Trade Center towers. And at the time, at the initial reports that were coming out, nobody knew really the size of the plane. They didn't know if it was a little Cessna or Piper or something that had inadvertently hit the tower for some reason. So there was just a lot of speculation. Oh, boy, you know, how could somebody not see that? Or was this intentional? Was it, you know, maybe some individual was trying to make some statement, or just, you know, taking his own life or something like that? So everybody was a lot of confusion about that. And so we're watching it, and he had it up on his computer. And I think it was about not long afterwards, the second plane, 20 minutes or so afterwards, slammed into the second building. And immediately once that took place, we knew immediately this was not done on accident. This had to be some sort of a orchestrated attack that was taking place. People began to gather around his computer as we were watching the news come in now on what was taking place. They started to talk about the people who had saw the first impact, saying that it was a large plane. It wasn't a small plane that had flown into the building. And so there was a girl working with us in that department who had friends in the World Trade Center. We were here in Greenville, South Carolina, but she had friends and loved ones that actually were still working. She had worked there for a while or had spent some time there, and she had friends and coworkers and loved ones that were in the tower during that time. So she was very upset. She began to cry and try to contact people back in New York. And so the company began to we ended up in a cafeteria with people just gathered around, glued to the television set as to what was taking place, what was going on during this time. Immediately then there were rumors that had come out about other planes that were in the air. People were unsure what was taking place, where these planes were during this time, and these types of things were coming. We're starting to be told by people, and so it just was a very, very confusing time. I remember in the room that how silent it was as people were watching the television screen. Let me give you a little bit of a play-by-play of what took place on that day. September 11th at 5:45 a.m., they had a snapshot of the hijacker, Mohammed Atta, passing through the airport security. Soon after that, 17 more hijackers would soon clear the security checkpoints at various airports. September 11th, 8:46 a.m., American Flight 11 slams into the floors, the floor number 93 to 99 of the World Trade Center on the North Tower. September 11th, 9:03 a.m. in the morning. So 8:46 was the first attack. Less than 15 minutes later, 12 minutes later, I think it was, United Flight 175 plows into the floors 77 through 85 of the World Trade Center's South Tower. September 11th, 9:37 a.m., just 34 minutes later, American Flight 77 crashes into the Pentagon. September 11th, 9:42, just, 5 minutes later, with almost 5,000 planes in the air, the FAA grounds all flights. You may remember during that time, F-15 fighter jets were scrambled during that time as well over some of the key locations in the United States. At 10:03 a.m., so we're talking another 15 or 18 minutes later, United Flight 93 crashes into the Pennsylvania field in Somerset County in Pennsylvania. September 11th, 8:30 p.m. that night, we're talking just 10 hours later, President Bush addressed the nation, calling the attacks, quote, evil, despicable acts of terror, unquote, and promising, quote, to find those responsible and bring them to justice. September 13th, Congress votes to allow President Bush to use, quote, all necessary and appropriate force, unquote, in responding to the terrorist attacks. September 17th, just 4 days later, after an unprecedented 4-day closure, Wall Street opens up again, of course, in downtown Manhattan. September 20th, during the address to Congress, President Bush promises a long, unremitting campaign against terrorism. September 21st, Congress passes a $15 billion bailout for the airline industry, and it sets up a trust fund for compensating 9/11 victims. September 24th, President Bush announces a freeze on all U.S. assets of terrorist groups, with international banks following suit after the United States did that. They followed after us and did the same as well. October 5th in Florida, a tabloid newspaper photo editor by the name of Bob Stevens dies from inhaling anthrax. A lot of people forget about that, that shortly after this attack, we also had all of those anthrax scares that took place as well, and actually Bob Stevens' loss of life with that as well. October 7th, the first bombing raid is conducted, and it rains down bombs on Afghanistan's Taliban regime and its Al-Qaeda allies in Afghanistan. 3 days later, October 10th, Tom Brokaw receives a letter, and NBC announces that anthrax has infected the anchorman Tom Brokaw's assistants, who had opened up the letter that was tainted. October 15th, as the anthrax hysteria is just taking over the country, it reaches Capitol Hill, where millions of spores are released from a letter mailed to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. October 12th, in 2002 then, terrorists with ties to Al-Qaeda bomb a resort island in Bali, killing more than 200 people. And it goes on and on. March 20th, 2003, the United States invades Iraq. December 13th, 2003, U.S. forces capture Saddam Hussein, who is later convicted and dies of hanging on December 30th, 2006. March 10th, 2004, 10 bombs explode in Madrid's commuter train section, killing 190 people. July 7th, 2005, 4 explosions rock London's public transportation system, killing more than 35 people. June 7th, 2006, a U.S. airstrike kills Abu Musab, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. January 2010, an audio tape from Osama bin Laden purportedly claims responsibility for an attempt to blow up a plane on Christmas Day 2009, and he warns the U.S. about future attacks. And then, of course, May 1st of 2011 of this year, U.S. forces kill bin Laden and raid on his Pakistani compound. So here's just a little bit of a snippet of some of the things that had taken place since that day, September 11, 2001. And you can just see, of course, and just reading through a few of those items, there are many more that I skipped over and left out of that, but you can just see the type of impact that this has had upon the nation that we live in. The events of that day are burned into people's memories, and 10 years later, people are still asking a lot of the same questions that they asked at the very beginning. They're asking questions like, where was God on 9/11? I think that we should ask ourselves as we think about this, what has the church's response been to these types of questions? Has the church come up with answers or spoken clearly as to what the scripture has to say about these things taking place? Well, there's many different ramifications of this as we think through this, and we need to ask ourselves, how are the people of God to answer not only that question that I just raised, but many other questions about the pain and suffering, not only on that day, but pain and suffering in general in the life that we live here on this planet. You know, to help Christians reflect biblically on those events, I wanted to read a number of comments today on the broadcast from what has been said by church leaders since that time. As we reflect now, we're 10 years later, as we reflect on what has taken place, not only on that day, but since then, all these other items, how should we be thinking about these things? How can we think about them biblically as we catalog all of these events? You know, let me tell you first and foremost that there is a resource that's available, a free resource for you. Ligonier Ministries is offering a complimentary copy of a special September edition of Table Talk Magazine. It's entitled 9/11, 10 Years Later. And in addition to the regular Bible studies and feature columns that they have in their regular issues of Table Talk magazine, this special issue contains articles about pastors and well-known Christian leaders reflecting upon the events that took place on that day. Articles such as the one written by Tabidi Anyabwile called The Gospel for Muslims. Although we obviously, as a nation, are wrestling with exactly how to handle the Islamic threat that has taken place in this country. I spoke about that the other day and gave some of my thoughts about how we should think about what is taking place with them. Tabidi focuses, and I think this is certainly an appropriate and accurate part of our response. How do we then share the gospel with Muslims, not only here, but around the world? And so they have an article in this special edition of Table Talk magazine that really summarizes Tabidi's book. He's got a book by the same name called The Gospel for Muslims, and it's put out by Moody Publishing. You can find out more about that. On my website on sermonaudio.com/knowingthetruth, if you go to the blog for today, I put hyperlinks to all of these topics that we'll be talking about today. Also, there is a pastor's reflection, another article that's written out there. This one is by Reverend Charles Drew, and his is called Can God Bless America, I think is the title of it. And actually, I think that was the one that was by John MacArthur. John MacArthur is asking that question. I think Charles Drew wrote a different one out there. But John MacArthur writes about, can God bless America? And he's just looking, you know, immediately people began talking about God's judgment on America and whether or not America was at the point of receiving the judgment of God. So it's a good question. It's a big question. It's a serious question. I think that there are some pitfalls that we need to avoid when we think about that subject. One is drawing a direct connection, or, you know, acting as if we can draw a straight line from a specific event that has taken place in this nation and the judgment of God as a result of a specific sin committed by the nation itself. I think we need to be careful there. This would seem to be the error of Job's friends, you know, that Job was going through something, and as he was going through it, his friends tried to draw a direct connection between what he was going through and a specific sin that they were trying to hone in on that was in the life of Job. And they did this unsuccessfully and were actually rebuked for trying to do it. It seems that some of the disciples of the Lord Jesus Christ tried to do the same thing. They saw a man who was suffering, and they said, who sinned, this man or his parents? And so they were trying to draw a straight line from the sin to the judgment that was taking place in this man's life, or the effects of sin that were taking place in this man's life. And the Lord Jesus Christ said neither, but that this was to show the glory of God. And so he dismissed, or seemed to dismiss in that case, you know, this propensity that we have of trying to draw a straight line. Many people have some sort of trial or trouble or suffering that takes place in their life, and they immediately say, is this taking place because God is punishing me for my sin? Well, sin certainly has negative responses. I'm just saying that in our day and age, apart from further revelation from God, making a connection between this event and this sin, we just don't have the information in order to draw a line succinctly and clearly between two events. We need to be careful about doing that. Is America ripe for the judgment of God? Well, I think that obviously the millions that have been slain in abortion, the rampant homosexuality that's taking place in our country, the infidelity that's taking place, the lack of religion and serious consideration about the things of God and the materialism, all of those things, obviously, are worthy of the wrath of God being poured out upon America. And yet there are other things. I think we're still living off of a tremendous amount of blessing that God has obviously placed upon America as well. So we can't draw a straight line between those two things. Dr. Sproul also has a section out there that's simply entitled 10 Years Later, where he reflects upon some of these items as well in this Table Talk magazine, and I would recommend it to you. There's a number of different things there that you can look at. What if, or if God, was another one. Ed Stetzer has one called A Religious Explosion. He looks at what took place right after the 9/11, the way that some churches experienced an uptick in their attendance, at least. It's a good question. How long did it last? Was it a legitimate turning to God or something else that we need to look at? There's a section there on loving our enemies. Should we, you know, how do we love our enemies in this situation? So there's a lot of good thoughts, and it's absolutely free. We'll get, maybe Gary can put a link to this out on the Christian Talk 660 website. The Ligonier Ministry program is heard here, Dr. R.C. Sproul, on this program. I think it's 9 o'clock on weekdays. And so we could put it under mine on the today's Knowing the Truth radio program. But like I'm saying, you can download this particular issue absolutely free. Or you can call them. And if you call Ligonier Ministries, you can request it and they'll send a copy to you right to your home. And so I would recommend that you go ahead and get it. It's just I found it to be very helpful. Let me read a little bit of R.C.'s response to what took place. This is, you know, R.C. has a brand new book out as well. It's called When Worlds Collide. He's got a couple other aspects of this. Maybe I'll read a few of them as well. One was called, Was 9/11 a Senseless Tragedy? And then another one was entitled, and this is put out on the Crossway blog, but it's called 9/11 Was a Blow to Moral Relativism. He continues in this one to say 9/11 shows the value of human life. This is what I meant. There's many, many lessons here that we can learn from this. I think there's a tremendous lesson about evil itself. There's a tremendous lesson about the depravity of man that we must think about. There's a tremendous lesson about the seriousness of how we should approach the gospel. I think you'll hear that in some of these other comments from well-known Christian leaders around the country. But let me read R.C.'s statement here, and you can see the types of things that are being said by some of the foremost leaders in Christianity today. Let me, his comments say this, quote, "We witnessed on 9/11 the absolute wickedness of an assault on human life. We also saw, with the implosion of those buildings, the practical end of macroevolution as a defining theory for the human species. Who really believes anymore that mankind is merely a grown-up germ? Who believes anymore that we are nothing but cosmic accidents emerging fortuitously from the slime and destined for annihilation? If we truly believe that, when we see pictures of thousands of people destroyed by an act of violence, it should merely make us yawn. The mass destruction of grown-up germs who have no eternal significance is no more important than going into our yard and using a cherry bomb to blow up an anthill. But every human being in America knows that he or she is not an ant. Every person on this planet knows that he or she is not a germ. We all know that human life is sacred and that human life is meaningful, which it could not be if there were no purpose for human existence, as macroevolutionists believe. If God does not exist, there is no purpose for human existence. we would be nothing more than, quote, useless passions, unquote. But if we understand the existence of God and relate our own existence to his existence, we know that human life is of great value. We know that human life matters. We know that it matters ultimately that human beings were murdered in the World Trade Center and at the Pentagon and on those four planes that went down on that day, unquote. So that's Dr. R.C. Sproul talking about these issues. We're going to talk about this some more as we go through the broadcast today. We're going to switch gears, though, here for just a second. And I want to bring into our discussion today Carlin Bowman. She's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And I want to discuss with her today a recent issue of American Enterprise political report entitled The War on Terror, 10 Years of Polls on American Attitudes. Have Americans basically forgot what has taken place there? That's what we're going to find out. What are they thinking now, 10 years later? Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
The one thing you can say about the news is it's never news for long. The stories we hear are changing all the time. And that's why you need to tune in to the next Janet Mefford Show. We'll bring you the most important news of the day, every day, inside the church and out, and always from a Christ-centered perspective. Plus, we want to hear from you. So don't miss the next edition of the Janet Mefford Show. We'll see you then.
Weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 on Christian Talk 660 at 92.9 FM.
It's great pizza for a great price. So pack up the family and head over to Speedy B's near Walmart on Woodruff Road in Greenville. At Speedy B's, you'll find friendly faces and at least a dozen pizzas out at all times. Or you can order a pizza and they'll make it fresh just for you at no extra cost. So visit Speedy B's today.
Hi, this is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and I want to take the time to thank John, Ruth, Carlos, and the good folks over there at Speedy B's Pizza for their support of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
I hear a lot of well-established Christian youth professionals say that clothing and hairstyles aren't battles that parents need to be fighting. I have to respectfully take issue with that. Hi, I'm Trace Embry with a thought from Shepherd's Hill Farm. If you allow your teenage son or daughter to dress in a manner associated with occult practices, gang activity, sexual perversions, and any other activity that may be contrary to a biblical worldview, who do you think your child is going to attract as friends? If your teen's desire is to dress in a fashion that identifies himself with a group that is contrary to anything Christ-like, your problem may be deeper than clothing. Unless he has a genuine missionary motive, how a person adorns himself is an outward indicator of how that person perceives himself. Teens often deny that dress is significant. That's when they need to be asked why they spend so much time, energy, and money to look the way they do.
Trace is the founder and director of Shepherd's Hill Farm, a Christ-centered and biblically-based program serving at-risk teens. Watch our video and learn more at shfteens.org.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome back into the second half of the Knowing the Truth radio program. In the first half of the program, I was reading and talking about some of the reflections in the Christian community from some Christian leaders, specifically R.C. Sproul, I was just quoting a few moments ago, and the folks from Table Talk magazine, which is a kind of a subsidiary there of Ligonier Ministries. But we were looking at them reflecting upon 9/11. We're 10 years now. This week will be the 10th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York City, of course. And I played that song by Alan Jackson in the beginning of the broadcast today. Where were you on that day? You know, were you in the backyard? Were you at work? Where were we at? Frankly, when we play that song, all of those emotions start coming back again. I start remembering what it felt like on that day. how vulnerable we were, the way that we weren't sure, is this just the beginning? Are there going to be one right after the other? What's life going to be like now that this has taken place? How could this have happened? All of these things. And then, of course, religious questions I was talking about as well. Where was God on 9/11? How should the church respond? How should the people of God answer these questions and many others? You know, the broader question of pain and suffering in our day and age. All of those important questions. Well, added to this discussion, I wanted to speak with Carlin Bowman. She's a senior fellow for the American Enterprise Institute. And I wanted to talk with her about one of AEI's political reports, their most recent one. It's called The War on Terror, 10 Years of Polls on American Attitude. So every year, for 10 years now, there have been polls taken about what Americans think about this in a number of different aspects. And I want to see, you know, the saying that came out of 9/11 from day one was that we will never forget. We will always remember what took place there. We'll never forget. Well, I want to see, have we forgotten? Has our attitude changed somewhat over 10 years now? And if so, where are we at? What's the current national mood or attitude about a number of these aspects of this attack? With that, Carlin, welcome to the Knowing the Truth radio program.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, I just set that up there. Is that correct, then, that for every year now for the past 10 years, AEI has been involved in these polls?
Well, we haven't taken the polls ourselves. We don't usually do that here. What I've been doing is collecting the polls in the public domain, the ones that your listeners probably hear about all the time, the Gallup polls, the ABC News polls, the New York Times polls. And I've been trying to make sense of that massive amount of public opinion data. And in fact, I think to the question you asked, have we forgotten? I think the answer is absolutely not. And there are some indications in the recent polls that I think support the view that in fact this made a very lasting, a very, very deep impression on the American people. The Pew Research Center asked a question very simple and straightforward. Do you remember where you were on the day of the attacks? And 97% of Americans remember what they were doing at the time of the attacks. You rarely see 97% of Americans agreeing or having the same views on something. So this has been a very, very deep and searing experience for Americans. That said, Americans do not say today that terrorism is the number one problem facing the country. They did immediately after 9/11. And today the economy, the job situations are much more present in Americans' minds. But I think the issue of terrorism is, if we can think of the burners on a stove, it's on the back burner at a very, very steady simmer, whereas the economy and jobs is at a full boil on the front burner overall. So Americans clearly haven't forgotten. It made a very deep impression. I think one of the reasons that it's receded a little in our views is because, and this is surprising given the very negative views about Washington these days, one of the things I think that's surprising is that Americans actually are crediting the government with doing a pretty good job in keeping them safe.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you, this is about a 10-page report that you have boiled it down to about 10 pages, is that correct?
Yes.
And it's available for free out on AEI?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
It's available for free on AEI's website, www.aei.org.
Okay, and again, we'll see if we can link to that, link to it on, I think it's already linked on my website, but I'll go ahead and see if we can put that under the show prep items on our website as well for our listeners' sake. Let me ask you if... what are some of the key findings then, as you boiled this down in just 10 pages, what are some of the things that stood out to you when you looked at this data?
Well, I think certainly the two that I mentioned early on, the fact that it has made an enormously lasting impression, one that's going to stay with the American people for a very long time, I think that's clearly a point. A second important point from the data is that Americans are giving the federal government credit.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that George W. Bush made the nation safer. And they also believe that Barack Obama will keep the nation safe. Mm-hmm. Going beyond that, Americans do believe that there will be another terrorist attack on American soil. They believe that they're terrorists probably operating in the country today. They think we've been lucky, mostly lucky thus far. Mm-hmm. Though, as I said, they do give government credit for doing a pretty good job in this area overall. One area that's certainly been a subject of much discussion is the area of civil liberties when you're fighting the war on terror. And when you ask Americans whether the average American will have to give up some of his or her civil liberties to fight the war on terror, about 60% gave that response immediately after 9/11, and that's about 40% today. So that's gone down. That's been a significant change in the data overall. That said, Americans clearly want government to err on the side of protecting them. They're willing, for example, they supported the Patriot Act. They support domestic surveillance of potential terrorists without a court order. Not surprisingly, Americans are very reluctant about using either torture or assassinations, but they don't want to rule either of those out. After Osama bin Laden was killed, 80% of Americans told NBC News Wall Street Journal pollsters that, in fact, it was the right decision to kill him rather than to capture him. Mm. And in many of the questions that have been asked in the polls, only about 25% say that torture is never justified to gain information. Mm. So again, the Americans facing a lot of practical changes in their lives. They seem to generally support the airline security measures and are not bothered by those measures at all, those protective measures overall. But some big changes in terms of civil liberties overall. If you ask them whether or not we're winning the war on terror, Americans are pretty sure the terrorists aren't winning. But they're not confident that we're winning either. They often give the response that neither side is winning the war on terror. It's clearly gone on for a long time, and though Americans are always very supportive of the military, when our soldiers are deployed abroad, they have supported President Obama's decision, about 70%, to draw down troops from Afghanistan. When you ask them whether taking the war to Afghanistan was the right thing to do, and many pollsters have asked that question quite a number of times since in the last decade, majorities of Americans say it was certainly the right thing to do. They believe today that it was the right thing to do. But that said, I think no one likes to have troops in harm's way, and Americans are probably no different in that sentiment than anyone else. So a lot of Americans are saying that perhaps now is the time to bring some of those troops back.
Hmm. Well, that is very insightful information. It seems that the American people trying to reconcile, you know, it's one act, one day of what took place, but now we're trying to make application to all of that in all of these different areas of our life. You talked about civil liberties, and, you know, that's an ongoing discussion. You know, how much do we give away in order to be safe?
Absolutely.
And so it's interesting to see how the American people pretty much, according to your data here that you've compiled, have a pretty balanced view on a lot of these things. It's not as skewed as you might think. What's the overall feeling? Are they depressed? Are the American people this is taking place, or is it their mood a little bit more upbeat and positive?
We were remarkably resilient after the terrorist attacks, even though Americans said in overwhelming numbers at the time of the attacks that they had cried, that they had had trouble sleeping, that they had prayed. It was clearly just enormously emotional. You saw those people went back to their normal lives pretty quickly overall, and the number who had trouble sleeping or who felt depressed declined pretty rapidly by October. In some of the polls, October 2001, most Americans were saying they were going on with their normal lives overall. You had a spike immediately after 9/11 in patriotic sentiment. More people said they were flying their flags or putting stickers on their cars. But that receded to the normal level, which is pretty high level of patriotic sentiment in the United States overall. And as you and your listeners know, I think America is in many ways a deeply religious country, and I think that many Americans will say they prayed after 9/11, and they will continue to say, certainly in these 10-year celebrations and anniversaries, excuse me, the 10-year anniversary of the attacks, that they will be praying again for the world, for the more dangerous world we live in.
Is there anything in the report about Americans' attitudes about Islam in general? I didn't see that when I read through it, or don't remember noticing it. But is there any, since this was conducted by radical Islamists, is there any sort of data talking about Americans' opinions? Are they suspicious of Islam? Are they, do they feel it needs to be cracked down upon and watched more carefully? Anything along that
line? What you see is that Americans make, again, a very sensible, what I think is a very, very sensible distinction overall. If you ask them, first of all, about half of us know someone who's a Muslim. That seems to be pretty consistent in the polls overall. Half do not. But if you ask Americans their views about Muslims in general and Muslim Americans, they're much more favorable than unfavorable. But if you ask them their views about Islam, there's more negativity about the religion as a whole. The pollsters have asked, for example, whether you think the Islam religion is more violent than other religions, or have asked about a number of religions and said to people that they're polling, well, which do you think is the most violent religion? A lot of people, of course, believe that Islam is the most violent religion. But still, in terms of Muslims in America, views about the Muslim community, those are very positive overall. Americans do support a kind of special scrutiny for potential terrorists, whether it's the domestic surveillance or whether it is airline security measures, but there's no indication in the data that I see of any kind of rising hostility to Muslims or Muslim Americans.
Interesting. Carlin, I want to thank you very much for your work there at AEI of putting together this material. You guys do an excellent job. There's a lot of great stuff. I'm going to give your website here in just a second, but I want to say thank you again for
taking
the time out to talk to us about this most recent report.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Okay. That was Carlin Bowman. She is one of the fellows at the senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. By the way, you can go out to their website. Their website is www.aei.org. That's aei.org. They put these reports out, these political reports, on a regular basis, and just chock full of a number of good things. They've right now out on the website are going to talk about Obama's set to outline his jobs plan tonight. There's another topic of conversation that we won't breach at this time. I wanted to go back to talk about a couple more of the statements that were made by some of the leading Christian evangelicals, and maybe I could even say for a lot of them in the Reformed movement, about what took place on 9/11. The other day on the radio program, I had Trevin Wax on the program on Tuesday. And by the way, Trevin is going to be with me each Tuesday for the month of September. Trevin has a section of his website that is called Worth a Look. And he goes out, and he basically becomes, his website becomes a little bit of an aggregate site where he grabs different articles from around the blogosphere, primarily the Christian blogosphere, and he aggregates them or compiles them out on his website. And so he's got a really good eye for good and interesting news stories. And so anyways, I was talking with him via email, and I asked him to be on the broadcast with me for the Tuesdays in September, where we are going to discuss a number of these things. This past Tuesday, day before yesterday, we talked about the most recent ones that he put out on his blog. Well, one of the items that we talked about was some of the theological lessons from 9/11. How should we be thinking about this as we're doing on the broadcast here today? And he put that question out to a number of other folks, and some of the, as I mentioned, some of the leading thinkers, Christian leaders and thinkers in the country today, responded to that. And here's a couple of the response. Matt Chandler, a lot of people know Matt Chandler's ministry, but he answered it this way. He says, quote, 9/11 created some legitimate seriousness in what I perceived in 2001 to be a general silliness among the bulk of young evangelicals, a comfort with a shallow end of the pool. This manifested itself in a concentration on what we should or shouldn't be doing that was driven by moralism and wasn't flowing from transformed hearts. The grief, fear, and shock of that day, revealed, revealed all of the comfort of the shallow end, and there was a need for transcendence, greater depth. We needed deeper water, depth that could help us understand how such things could happen, could show us where God was on that day, depth that could help us worship when everything else was going wrong and when everything else was going, or when everything else was going right. An understanding of God that went beyond our personal safety, our personal bank accounts and health. We need an understanding of the nature and the character of God and how he interacts with his covenant community, how he interacts with the fallen world, and where our hope should be placed. And so I thought that was an interesting comment, again, by Matt Chandler about this subject. He's looking at that it drives us to be more serious about the things that we say that we believe. And he notes that we have had been, up until that point, maybe lulled into, just a lack of the seriousness that the scriptures demand. In my own congregation, I've been teaching, you've heard me mention many times on the broadcast, through Psalm 119. The Psalm, 176 verses, many of the verses deal with suffering and affliction, intense suffering and affliction. And as I have been speaking to my own congregation, I have said that my job is to prepare you for suffering. That there is suffering that is going to take place in this life. You are going to be called to suffer in one way or another. And because of that, my part of my responsibility, based upon what I see in the Word of God, is to prepare you for suffering. And so we talked about, you know, how to handle suffering, even though at the time when we began that study, very few people in the congregation may have been going through very difficult times of suffering. But within the time period, it takes a long time to go through 176 verses, one verse a week, typically, for the most part. It takes years to do this study. So during that time, people in the congregation have been called upon to go through just some of the most unimaginable suffering you could think of. Some people may not have lost a loved one in 9/11 in the attacks on the World Trade Center, but people have 9/11s happen in their life every day, meaning that their world around them comes crumbling down, that the loss of the life of a loved one, the words of the doctor telling them that the lump is cancerous. These things happen in people's lives on a daily basis, and for Christians, we need to understand that this is the life that we live here, and we need to be prepared. Here's one thing I've learned over the years of ministry: the time to prepare is not when you're in the hospital, not when you're either yourself in the hospital or you're up there visiting with a loved one in the hospital. It's a very, very poor time to start to prepare. There's so much information coming. There's so much emotion flowing. There are so many people up at the hospital that are coming and saying things and doing things. You're trying to make decisions. You're tired. You're hungry. There's no way that during that time, if you haven't begun to prepare already before that, that you are going to be able to cut through all that and suddenly begin to start thinking more seriously about these things. You need to have, previous to that, thought about these things, have a foundation to build upon as you go through these things. I remember Dr. Moeller speaking about that when he was in, you remember a couple years ago, he actually had some very serious surgery done. And he said that one of the things that stood out to him during that time was, is that he had never thought about the effects of medication. Here he was under pain medication, and trying to think about the gospel, trying to have a proper perspective about what was going on, but basically you're all drugged up during this time. And he was saying and articulating the difficulty during that time of trying to do that because of the drugs. Let me read another one to you. Here's one by Kevin DeYoung. I like a lot of the stuff that Kevin DeYoung writes about and says. He seems very, very practical, and yet, thinks deep about these subjects. Here is a quote. He says, I was just starting my last year of seminary on September 11, 2001. My theology of preaching was already pretty well set after reading Calvin and Edwards and the Puritans and a lot of Lloyd Jones. I knew what I wanted to be as a preacher that would try to give people a big picture of a big God. 9/11 didn't change my convictions about ministry or about preaching, but it certainly confirmed that pastoral ministry could not skirt past the hard issues of life. I didn't want a God, a theology, a view of eternity, or an approach to ministry that would look trite next to the rubble of the Twin Towers. Well, I agree. I think that, you know, the a serious study of the Word of God. We are the only people upon the face of the earth that have reasonable and accurate is certainly appropriate answers to what is taking place when suffering occurs. We've got the only theology that can do that upon the face of the earth, and so it's very important that we use it that way. Tabidi Anyabwile, let me read to you one more. Tabidi wrote the book, of course, about the gospel to Muslims. I had actually sent Tabidi an email asking him to be on the program today, but we weren't able to pull that together in time. I have to get him on a future broadcast. But this is what he says. When 9/11 occurred, I was walking from a comfortable night's sleep in an upscale San Antonio hotel. While dressing, I watched the news footage, like most people, dumbstruck. After I gathered a good sense of what was taking place, I called to check on my wife and my daughters in D.C. I joined my co-workers gathered together in a hotel conference room for a discussion on public policy and improving the life outcome of children and families. When I arrived, I found the room was heavy with confusion and sadness and fear. We were a collection of policy professionals from around the country, lots of us with family and friends in Washington, D.C. and in New York. In the silence, confusion, and sporadic telephone connections with family were the questions, what's going on? And who is in control? A few dared to ask, is God involved in this in any way? I was a lone evangelical in the group of committed politicians and social progressives. I wasn't in the room 3 minutes before everyone was looking to me for an answer and for a prayer. That scene reminds me that everyone needs to answer some basic, deep questions about life. Is God involved in my life? Who is in control? How do I explain this pain? It also taught me that at bottom, we all need to encounter the majestic, glorious, merciful, and awesome God of the Scriptures. He is the only God there is. And when we really need Him, we need Him in all of His brightness and splendor. Suffering people hardly settle, or can hardly settle, for a puny God. So I want to preach in such a way that recognizes that the God that I serve is the God who truly holds all things in his hands. He rules and reigns with no rivals. And when the world seems to come undone, the sovereign God of the Bible is who we need. In truth, we need that God all the time. And the purpose of preaching in a post 9/11 world is to simultaneously reveal him in sovereign glory while stripping away at the mundane to expose our deep need for him. Most of us live in a routine-induced daze that distracts us from the ultimate matters. Preaching is the audible interruption of that daze to ask, do you see this great God? Come and love him. Well said. And I hope that's what we do this Lord's Day. Remember, Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Life-changing teaching and talk for the Carolinas and Georgia. Christian Talk 660. WLFJ, Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson.